Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. Our buddy Max Armstrong will be along in just a few minutes with a special guest. Well, Wall Street had another good week. For the week, the S&P was up 1.4%. The Dow was up 1.3%. The NASDAQ composite rose 2.1%. On Friday, a fairly lackluster day, not a lot of movement, and the Dow was down about 6 points at 21,077. For the S&P, it was another record close, the 20th of the year, up about a half a point at 2416. And the NASDAQ also hit a record high at the close, up about 5 points at 6,210. Let's bring in Susan Schmidt, one of my favorite guests, to talk about the equities today and what's going on in the markets. She's the Senior Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager at Westwood Holdings Group in Dallas. And hello, Susan.
Hello.
Well, a pretty good week. It was kind of a breather on Friday, wasn't it?
It was, but not unusual. We're going into a three-day weekend. No one wants to have a lot of exposure going into a long weekend. And remember that this is really the start of summer. So now we're going to start to see volumes come out of the market, activity slow down a little bit. As summer months happen, the market tends to be a little less active, fewer participants as different people take vacations at different times. So not unusual that we saw things taper, but still overall a very strong week. Things really just settled down. They didn't go negative to any extent. This has been a strong market thus far this week.
Is it a part of it that investors are fairly comfortable with their positions, and that's why there wasn't a lot of movement today?
I think that's it. I think also we haven't gotten a whole lot of new news flow. Earnings was the last big information dose that came out, so we saw a lot of new information from the earnings reports. The market wanted to hear management teams talk about their businesses and how they were doing. I think that they got that comfort, and now they're looking forward. We had a good revision in the GDP estimate today. So the GDP estimate that we'd seen prior was an up 0.7%, disappointing. Today, that number got revised, and so the year-over-year GDP growth, now 1.2%. So that's very positive. So we saw that. We saw some bolstering. We also saw a good, healthy consumer confidence number come out today, so holding at about 97. So all those things, I think, positive underpinnings for the market. And people are looking at businesses saying these are still a good thing to invest in. Bond yields are low. I don't have a lot of alternatives. Globally, the U.S. market still seems to be the most stable. So it still attracts attention.
We saw a big jump in gold today, up the highest it's been since the 1st of May. Why was that?
I think gold can be an emotional trade or reaction. Sometimes people seek gold for safety. It can be a safe haven at times, and certainly has been when people are concerned about currencies. We didn't see a lot of extreme movement in currency today, and so I think gold in this case is really people looking for other places to store their assets using another vehicle. And we did have some disruption during the week. Remember, we had some movement in oil this week as well because the OPEC meetings happened. And so people are looking at those big asset classes, gold, oil, stocks, fixed income, trying to figure out how to displace the assets across them.
Did you see any response from Wall Street to the president's comments about NATO allies and the German economy, German cars?
Not. And so I think the market here is showing a good degree of maturity in learning how our new president communicates and understanding that President Trump has some statements that perhaps are more blunt, more direct, perhaps a little bit harsher than his predecessors. And the market is learning to tune those out and not get too caught up in that. The markets didn't seem at all fazed by the comments that were made in Europe. They seem to be, again, focused back on the fundamentals, largely ignoring that. Despite the macro news, we had big macro news out of the Congress, the House this week, trying to understand what happens as, again, the health care bill starts to come back up into play. So the market, I think, is doing a good job of focusing on what's important, company earnings, and ignoring the noise that's still circulating above.
It seems like the technology sector is still a place where a lot of investors are putting their money, despite the fact that some of the stocks like Facebook and Netflix and Amazon have had some incredible gains so far this year. I gather that investors still see growth in tech.
We're still seeing seeing strength in tech stocks. We're seeing some underlying support, some relative strength. It seems to be a favored sector of the market. It's an area where investors are comfortable putting their money. They feel that even at these elevated valuations relative to where they were a year ago, that despite that, they're big names with a lot of liquidity. And if you want exposure to the U.S. markets, those are all names that are in the S&P 500. So they're going to be names that you end up owning. It doesn't seem like people are getting scared off there. Tech news has been solid, and earnings, if anything, surprised to the upside. So, again, giving comfort to that incremental investor in technology.
So coming up on Tuesday after the three-day weekend, the Memorial Day weekend, what's coming up? Anything that's going to drive the market that you can see?
Tuesday, we actually are going to see the April personal consumption expenditure index, and that PCE number, that's important because we want to know how people are spending. People spending, getting money back into the economy, getting that circulating, that's going to impact prices and inflation. Ultimately, that is a determinant that the Fed is looking at to try and figure out how to deal with interest rates. Because remember that the Fed is looking at inflation as one of the metrics that they're watching to see how that moves as inflation moves up, and the Fed has a target around 2%, the Fed is more likely or more inclined to raise interest rates. So the other big number, and I think the one to focus on really, is a week from today. So the May jobs report is going to come out on Friday, June 2nd. So next Friday, we'll see how the jobs fared. We've seen steady growth in this area for the most part. We're seeing very low unemployment numbers, and average hourly earnings are growing moderately. So about up 0.2-0.3% year over year. And that's steady growth. The market's comfortable with that. Could always be better. But that low unemployment number is what's really going to capture the market's attention. We haven't seen that translate yet into pressure on costs for businesses and costs on operations and as their labor costs go up. But we expect to see that flow through. So the market's waiting for signs to see when that's going to happen.
Well, we are in May, and there is that old saying about May, right?
We do. We are at the classic sell in May and go away time period. And so there is that wonderful phrase that hangs out there forever, sell in May and go away. If you go back over 60 years of data, it will show you that if you did sell in May and go away and come back in September post the summer months, you might do ever so slightly better, less than a tenth of a percent better in one of the studies that I've seen. So in reality, there's no big change. And I would say that if we go back on a shorter time period, we've seen a lot of activity in the summer months in recent years, whether it's been because of a global event, news out of Washington, or just changes in earnings reports and the market reacting a little bit more aggressively than it has, say, 40 years ago. It serves to pay attention over the summer. I don't think going away is such a good idea.
Okay. I won't go away then. I'll hang in there. The S&P 500 had its 20th record close this year, which in itself is fairly phenomenal, but the S&P has been doing very well overall, correct?
Yes, it has. It's amazing that it keeps going upwards. We do have an interesting factoid out there that we have had 231 sessions without a 5% drawdown in the S&P 500. That is remarkable. And so that's actually an interesting data point that we have today. That's the longest period we've gone without a 5% drawdown since 1996, and the sixth longest since the inception of the S&P 500. But I do think that the upward trend in the S&P is indicative of, you know, still the global situation. And we talked about this a year ago. Interest rates globally are still very low. There aren't a lot of places to invest where you can get a return. As a shareholder, investing in a profitable business that has a high return on equity or return on capital, you're benefiting from that. So indirectly, that is like a dividend yield coming out of a stock in actual business as opposed to a bond instrument. And I think that's one of the things that keeps the U.S. equity market doing well, is that the options still are not exceptionally attractive anywhere else.
And even though, to a point you made earlier, that there still seems to be some uncertainty about whether the Trump platform, the tax cuts, the infrastructure spending, whether that's going to happen this year or if at all.
I think there is a lot of uncertainty around that. It's certainly increased, and we're in a very different mindset than we were back in November when Trump was first elected. So President Trump's agenda now, it's, I think, clear to the market that it's going to take a lot longer to execute. It's not clear how much of his initial plans will actually get executed and take hold within the economy. It is not atypical to see the market expectations race up at the first news of that and then slowly scale down as timing and reality take over and present perhaps more of a challenge to getting things done.
Well, we haven't seen a lot of scaling down, though, have we?
No, but we've had good earnings news to support it on the other side of that. So I think we were seeing some very positive earnings reports and good indicators from the economy and companies coming out on the other side. So it presented a nice balance for us, and I think that's what contributed to this upward climb that we've seen.
It's always a pleasure and educational to have you on with me, Susan. Susan Schmidt, Senior Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager at Westwood Holdings Group in Dallas. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander, and here comes our buddy Max Armstrong with a special guest.
I was in a part of central Illinois this past week, a little bit east of Bloomington Normal. The fields were not flooded. The corn has a good start. Things were looking pretty good there. And yet I continue to hear from growers who say this may be their worst corn planting season. Well, a couple of guys have said in 40 years, and they're 40 years of farming. They're a contemporary of mine, about my age, and they say this is a bad one. Why is the market not reflecting it? And, of course, that's what's on the mind of the growers, too. Why isn't it showing that this is a lousy corn planting season? Well, of course, statistically, if you look at the weekly crop bulletin, everything is swell.
Well, you have to look at where it's planted. You know, we planted a lot, but we planted in those areas in April where you talked about, and those areas also have some pre-plant coming. We planted well in South Dakota, North Dakota, where it's dry, actually, and in Minnesota and Iowa to some extent, but they still have some left. But I think it's the areas that have not been planted yet, and what are they going to look like come next week when we have a new progress report. And I think it's a little deceiving to show that the progress of where we're at. There is a lot of land that isn't planted that hadn't even been touched yet, a lot of soybean ground that hasn't been touched. And I've driven from Chicago on 88, from DeKalb East, that looks pretty good. You go north of there and northwest, and I drove down today for the interview, and, of course, there's nobody in the field. And there's just acres and acres and acres of land that hasn't been touched yet. So we're hearing from a lot of people now that can they replant? Can they get back in again in Ohio, really, and Indiana and in Illinois? And will the weather let us get planted again? And all the while we're doing this, the market is looking at the 2 billion bushel of corn carryover we have, 2.2, and a 400 million bushel bean crop. We've got plenty left over for a cushion next year, if we have one this coming year that we're going to grow. So I think that's what the market's focusing on. And I think a lot of guys have ignored the fact this is a futures market. This isn't a past market. That's old news. And if we had so much, then corn ought to be $3.10, you know, not $3.80 or something for these corn. And beans ought to be a lot worse than they are. So there's some concern about beans getting planted as well.
When we look at this acreage number, we're not really going to have a good handle on it until what, the fourth week of June when the USDA comes out with planted acreage numbers?
Yeah, and even then, you know, we've seen this before where we're going to get an interview the first 2 weeks or the first 10 days of June.
So it's going to be a tentative number at that point. It's going to be in flux at that point.
That's right. And we've had to wait sometimes until October where we finally found out what the deal was. But I think we'll get a pretty good hint in on June 30th. And again, it's the they'll look at it and say, all right, we ask you in March what you intended to do. Now, what have you done, and what do you intend to do from here? So we'll get a pretty good handle on that. And the provisions for doing prevent plant and replant and so forth have changed somewhat. So almost if you're going to replant, they almost force you to replant corn and do some hanky-panky things with the crop insurance thing. So it's not as easy to figure out yet. And, of course, a lot of people in the Eastern Corn Belt have planted corn the first week in June the last couple of years and got 200 bushel an acre. So that seems to be the norm, you know. And farmers can always kind of complain how tough it is. And the traders, you know, at the Board of Trade will say, well, you guys complain all the time, but in the end you grow a record crop. So prove to me you can't do another one. So it could be, it could take a while.
The comparison with a year ago is a tough one because the yields were so good. Where are you in regard to what our yield prospects look like now? How much have we trimmed it, Jerry?
Well, I think we have to start at 168 as an average, perhaps. And I think if we get an average crop, we're going to be fortunate. Minnesota and North Dakota, North Dakota doesn't plant a whole lot, but Minnesota, South Dakota, and even Nebraska's in trouble yet. We have a lot of clients out there that are still trying to replant or plant. So it's Iowa, that Western Corn Belt's going to have to really come through with a good crop to get the average. So average is some good and some bad, so there are some good out west. I wouldn't doubt that we see probably 166, and that's still pretty good. The people, you know, we talk about the progress progress of our planting. We talk about a five-year progress. Well, let's talk about a five-year average. That's 159 bushels an acre. A seven-year average is 156. We had some bad years in there. So if we want to do all that, we need to look at that. And the market doesn't want to look at anything that implies that we're not going to have enough corn next year at this time.
How do you answer that person who says, well, hey, our varieties continue to improve, they are hardier, that it doesn't make sense to look back 10 years?
Well, it's true, probably, because I'm not looking at 140 bushel acre corn either. But I think the one thing that we've overlooked is that in these 2 years that we've had record crops, we had good crops worldwide. The main ingredient in that whole thing was enough moisture. So we were above moisture in a lot of countries, including the United States, Canada, you go into Europe, and same thing. What happens if we go back to norm? Can we really stand a normal year? And probably these technologically advanced seeds will do better in a normal year. But that takes away that rain, and I think that gives us a problem, especially as dry as we are in the north now. If that continues, that we haven't seen a drought in North Dakota, and I grew up in a drought up there, but we haven't seen a problem up there in years across that northern Minnesota and North Dakota area. But I think the main ingredient is that we've exceeded that the norm by a significant amount. And can we do it 3 years in a row? We probably never have done that. So,
what's the price prospect when you're talking about that kind of production?
Well, I hear a lot of analysts say, well, you know, if you get a price spike, be sure, you know, sell and defend or whatever it is, or make sure you capture some of that. You have to ask yourself, why is it in the past few years we've not seen corn stay above $4 very long, unless we had it last June, we had it higher than that. If it gets up there, you have to ask yourself, why is it there all of a sudden? Why is that person wanting to pay me $4.20 or $4.30 for my corn when they didn't want to pay me $3.80 a while back? What changed? And probably we underestimate where we could go. I think $4.50 corn, and then there's the technicians out there would tell you that there's a gap back there at $5.50. People say, well, I'll never see that again. You know, some of the global banks will tell us we're in covered up with corn forever. That can change in a heartbeat. So I think you have to take a look at anything above $4.50 is then you have to question it. But they could go there pretty easily.
So you're cautioning folks against getting too bearish here.
Yeah, I seldom reveal what we have in positions, but we have no new crop corn cash contracted or hedged. We had some in the past, but it's all flat. I'll accept the risk from here, you know. At $4.50 or $5, I'll pass the risk off to you. At some point, I'll accept the risk. And if that's the least amount that you can pay me under the conditions that we have growing now, and it won't get any better from here until the time I harvest that crop or have to sell it a year from now, we got major problems in agriculture that we haven't seen yet.
Soybeans, we're going to boost the acreage. Yep. In your mind, your mindset here. How much will the acreage be jacked up on beans? Yield prospects, they haven't dimmed yet on soybeans, have they?
No, I don't think so. We still have time with yield and beans, but again, that depends on August weather. And again, you have to decide some things in your own mind. We need heating degree units in corn. Now, when are we going to get them? We didn't get them in May, and we're probably not going to get them until after the 15th of June. So when do you want them? Do you want them at a time that you don't want them for beans? And that could hurt us in August. But I think we have to start at 48 or 50 and work down from that. And again, much to the chagrin of a lot of people, I think we can use 90 million. We better grow 90 million acres of beans because that's
it's going to be needed, you're saying.
It's going to be needed. Globally, we increase the demand globally by 3.5% to 5% a year. And if you've noticed in the news with China and other people, again, we've underestimated the demand, not just for China, but for the other nations that are out there. And it isn't all about China anymore. So we focus on China. And, you know, I think as someone said a week ago on your show, that's only 50 or 60% of the growth in the last 10 years. There's other areas out there. And I think just about every country, we looked back and did some research. It's about every country we follow in multiple countries all over the world. They're all eating more feed grains and more protein. So we don't have a demand problem. We just grew a little bit too much the last couple of years. And like I think Orion said once, his dad told him, I remember this from I started farming, you know, was that his dad once told him, if things are good, they're probably going to get bad. And if things are bad, they're probably going to get good. So we're due for a good one.
We can't always assume that it's going to get hot and dry in the days of July and August. There have been some people talking about that, to be sure. I guess one thing that comes to mind is this corn crop won't have as well-established root system on it. If it does turn dry, it's going to be a little more challenging, is it not?
Yes, and if we continue to plant, we're going to be planting in mud, you know, probably, and I don't think many of us want to do that, so we'll probably switch what isn't planted now or doesn't have fertilizer on it, nitrogen in particular. But, yeah, you got to wonder what you're wishing for, you know, out here. And if it continues cool and we do turn hot, then those shallow-rooted plants of some acres, and, of course, last week, a week ago, last Monday, we had 7 million acres of corn left in a few key states that hadn't been planted yet. That's a lot of that's a lot of acres. So what portion of those are going to be subject to that problem out there? And we also have a lot of clients of ours calling from Central Illinois, where maybe you hadn't been, but there's some areas that they're going to replant. They're saying, I'm debating whether I should let 18,000 to 22,000 stand population or not.
That's a tough call to make, that replant call. But boy, and as we talked about this earlier, and I probably overemphasized the fact that I was in a pocket that really looked good. You know, given the fact of what growers are telling me, it's kind of a narrow crack there. I mean, you go north or south or east or west, and it's a mess. I was flying at 30,000 feet, looking out the window over southern Indiana about 10 days ago, and it was just pond after pond and lake after lake as the sun was glaring off, you know, with a reflection there. Does this have a feel to you, Jerry, of any other year that, you know, can you make any kind of a comparison and say, boy, you know, this kind of reminds me of what took place back then?
It's been a while. I hear people talking about 1983 being that way, but that was a pick year and I didn't plant much corn. I didn't care. But in the last 10 years, or actually since 2000, I don't remember anything quite like this. Many of the people we talk to say in 40 years, they haven't seen it. And I have a friend that I talked to just yesterday, a large farmer. I remember him when he was gone from the restaurant when I was going in. I was always a day late and a dollar short. I farmed twice as much as he did. Now he farms 10 times as much. And he said, I've never seen a year like this. And he said, you know, he said, I'm sick of it. He said, I'm going to haul wet corn, he said, into an elevator and dry it. And if I do plant it, and he said, there isn't another 40 or 50 cents a bushel for drying costs here. So I think he's economically minded enough that he's going to make that switch on probably 4,000 or 5,000 acres or something.
Economically minded, and that's an important point here. I mean, growers aren't robots that they have to plant this and plant that year after year after year. They're going to respond. They're going to look at the price prospects, right?
Yeah, one of the fallacies I've heard, and having been at the Board of Trade for a while, and we've since moved out because there wasn't much to learn there anymore. All the old guys that were smart are gone, and I'm one of those old guys, and I don't want to teach anybody. So, I think the premise out there that, and I've heard it, I continue to hear it, well, farmers love to plant corn, and once they sit on a tractor seat, they're going to continue to plant corn. That went out with, not with the Hetzel, but that went out quite a while ago. We love to plant things that grow, that make us money. And like I told my hired man once, the only thing green I want at the end of the year is money in my pocket. So we got smarter earlier this year, or are smart. You don't farm 5 or 10,000 acres and be a fool. You know, you look at it and you know your cash flow. We're less smart than we were 20 years ago or 10 years ago. So if we looked at the March 31st intentions, and our survey showed the same thing, we didn't want to plant feed grains. We planted less barley, less sorghum, less corn, and I think that continues. And we planted more soybeans, and I think that's probably this accentuates that problem. I think when we all get all done, how many acres of corn we didn't plant versus how many beans we did, probably going to be surprising unless we go into this prevent plant PP area. And a lot of guys are saying now this is looking pretty good. Break even looks good now. And even if you can make 50 bucks an acre, you're looking pretty good.
We haven't even talked about exchange rates. Any thoughts on the dollar? And, of course, we have to talk about the real because it's gone through some gyrations. Yeah. Has that all calmed down?
Well, that real thing is a very complex situation in Brazil. And as a buyer, you need to ask yourself, how much tied to the hip do I want to be to someone that's questionable. And what are they going to come up with? They can't just, they have to go to Congress, I think, and appoint a president. If they do impeach him, it takes time. So now you've got people that want to, that are mad. They're going to take to the streets. Are we going to get strikes? What's Argentina going to say about all this? And will that farmer in Brazil and Argentina, either one, part company with his grain, which is the best asset that he has against the real or the peso, and opt to sell it? And I think not, because the Argentine guy has fooled people before and held a lot more grain. So I think that's a fluid situation that is going to evolve. J.B. Penn once said, you know, J.B. Penn, he has some...
Chief economist of John Deere these days.
Very, very good. And I'm sure I paid part of his salary because I'm overhauling a tractor now. But anyway, he made a comment that currency rates are important when there's too much. In other words, now I've got to compete with South America to see who can get rid of the surplus. If you need grain, currency rates don't mean much. You're going to pay what it takes. It's a food. It's a staple item. It may mean something to TVs and clothes and cars and stuff, but not necessarily the food. So if we don't get a crop, it matters not. And what has gone by us a little bit kind of silently is the fact that the dollar is trading now below where Trump got elected. And Obama has said it was too high. You listen to the guy that has the purse strings, you know. And Trump said the same thing when he's in there. The dollar really is too high, and we've done nothing but deteriorate down. So that's good for agriculture, and that's good for us. I mean, in U.S. agriculture. So I'd like to see that dollar deteriorate further. We're a long way from where we were in 8 years ago. We've rallied quite a bit. And so we have a place to drop this stuff in. What better thing to do to happen when you can sell beef to China and beans to China? And, you know, this is, I've said it before on the show, I think agriculture is the best place to be in the business 10 years ago, and I say it today. You know, I wouldn't want to be doing anything else.
Always enjoy our visits. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Thank you.
Jerry Gokey, Gokey Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
You are listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And at the Chicago Board of Trade, soybean futures fell to a 13-month low on Friday, while corn and wheat each gained more than 1% on spreading and position squaring ahead of a three-day weekend. Some traders sold soybeans and bought corn as wet weather in the Midwest was likely to slow the final phases of corn planting. The farmers typically plant corn first since it has a longer growing season than soybeans. Wet weather in parts of the plains and Midwest could also damage maturing wheat plants, bolstering both the Chicago Board of Trade's soft red winter wheat futures as well as the Kansas City hard red winter wheat futures. Again, most of the futures will not be traded on Monday's Memorial Day holiday. Meanwhile, Chicago Mercantile Exchange live cattle futures on Friday finished sharply lower, hit by fund liquidation and the morning's bearish USDA cattle on feed report. The report showed the number of cattle placed in feedlots in April hit a 14-year high for the month. June live cattle ended $1.22.5 lower at $122.70 per hundred, and August live cattle were down $2.45 at $118.95. Both contracts finished below their respective 10-day moving averages of $122.89 and $120.02. Feeder cattle futures tumbled almost 3% on profit-taking, technical selling, and live cattle futures sell-off. August feeders ended $4.17 lower, 2.6%, at $146.95. Meanwhile, hogs were going the other direction, with June hogs 87.5 cents higher at $81.82.5 a hundred, and marked a new high of $81.87.5 during the trading day. U.S. government data on Friday morning showed the average wholesale pork price was up 49 cents per hundredweight from Thursday at $90.79. That wraps it up for The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, and along with Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.